This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. As many of you know, in recent shows, we always talk about this day in medicine, but recently, we've talked a lot about cardiac disease. Matter of fact, December 7th, 1967, we commemorated when Dr. Adrian Kantrowitz performed the second heart transplant and the first heart transplant in the United States at Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn. Then, last week on December 21st, we again commemorated in 1967 when Louis Washkansky died. He was the first patient to receive a heart transplant in South Africa by Dr. Christian Barnard. So I was thinking about this when I heard about today's guest. Today's guest is going to be Dr. Dina Al-Ramini. Dr. Al-Ramini is a cardiac surgeon at Hartford Healthcare, and she recently performed the first beating heart transplant performed in Connecticut. Now, many of you are saying, what is he talking about, a beating heart transplant? And as always, it's something I didn't know and needed to learn about before today's interview. But to summarize, a beating heart transplant is a revolutionary procedure that can increase the number of available heart donors. And I'll leave it at that. So Dr. Al-Ramini is going to come on in the second half of today's program to really talk about this procedure and some of the astounding facts that I didn't know about that go on at Hartford Hospital, where they're doing approximately 2,000 heart procedures a year. And there are 8 cardiac surgeons there. There's a tremendous, as we say in sports, bench or a group of doctors just to perform heart operations. And this is going to be a great chat with her to learn more about a beating heart transplant. As always, as I mentioned, this day in medicine. So December 28, 1895, Dr. Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen presented a paper called A New Kind of Rays. And he talked about the use of X-rays and their application to medicine. Now, the term Röntgen is also known to us because it's a unit of measure for the exposure of X-rays and gamma rays. So when you see X-ray technologists or people who work in X-ray often wearing badges, right, their little extra badges, those measure the absorption of X-ray or radiation. So you'll know that how much they may have absorbed over a period of time and if they need to get away from that exposure for a period of time. So again, the Röntgen, and we remember Dr. Röntgen for his paper that he presented back on this day in 1895. Now, coincidentally, in 1895, on the same day, there was a paper presented. Actually, it wasn't even a paper. It was a clinical application of X-ray. So Dr. Franz Exner in Vienna, Austria, used the first clinical use of X-ray in looking at a gunshot wound. So again, December 28th in 1895 was a big step forward for the use of X-rays clinically. and our understanding of exposure to x-rays themselves. Another thing on this day, December 28th, in the world of Christianity and Catholicism, today is the Feast of the Holy Innocents. Now, this is a feast that's been commemorated since 485 AD, and it's a day of somber remembrance of martyrdom of all baby boys in Bethlehem shortly after the birth of Jesus. And when I think of that, and how somber that is to think about children dying, it immediately brings to mind the catastrophe in Newtown 12 years ago in this season, in this month. Altogether, there have been 112 school shootings in 2024. What's more astounding is all of these incidents were preventable if we had reasonable gun safety laws. And guns remain the leading cause of death among children and teens in America. Just think about that. It's not disease. It's not from childbirth. It is guns that still continue to be the leading cause of death. And we hear this time and again, year after year. Now, when we think about what are we going to do about it, it's fairly simple. You know, in medicine, it's a lot of detective work, right? You'll see a pattern and you try to find one cause, right? What ties all of these things together, whether it be an epidemic, right? We just went through a pandemic. Again, we tied it all together by exposure to a COVID virus. So again, if we think about these deaths every year, the one common factor is a gun. Okay? Now, when we think about that, what are reasonable gun safety laws? So in this country, we have a Second Amendment, and people have rights. And how do you not impede a person's rights to bear arms? Right? So there is the rub. But reasonable gun safety laws don't have to impede a person's right to obtain and own a gun. What does it look like? It looks like background checks. Right, let's find out who's buying that gun. Who is buying that lethal weapon? What about a psychological evaluation? I keep hearing, well, it's a mental health crisis. It's not a gun crisis. That's not true. That's just not true. But are people who are buying guns in some way psychologically unstable? Are they prone to killing themselves? Or are they prone to death by suicide? What is the problem? So again, a psychological evaluation could be key. And more importantly, we need national laws against gun access to children, whether they be in homes and cars. We're always hearing about a child who got into a parent's gun in a nightstand or some other access to a gun and either shoots themselves or shoots a playmate. So again, these are just three basic things that could stop this crisis. Now, I personally fail to accept the adage that people are saying, well, there's no way to prevent this. We live in the greatest country of the world, right? And if we purport that to be true, we can solve this problem, right? And when you think about 112 school shootings in 2024 that are preventable with reasonable gun safety laws, I know we can solve this problem. So with that, we remember on this Feast of the Holy Innocents all of the children who have died just by going to school. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back to talk a little bit more about some updates in medicine. If you wish to reach me, you can email me at info@alessimd.com. As I mentioned, in the second half of today's program, we're going to be talking about heart transplantation with Dr. Dina Al-Ramini. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And in this part, I wanted to talk a little bit about a recent article published in JAMA Neurology. And the article is titled, "The Perceived Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy and Suicidality in Former Professional Football Players." Now, I think everyone has heard of the term CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And basically, CTE involves a specific neuropathologic finding that is found at autopsy. It's important to note that CTE cannot be diagnosed in living patients. So there is this perception among living former professional football players and other athletes. But in this particular study, they worked off of the data bank of 4,180 former professional football players. And with CTE, it is very specific. Now, there has been a term around since 2014 called traumatic encephalopathy syndrome. Now, this is a group of symptoms that may be associated with CTE. But suicidality was not among them. They felt that it was premature to use suicidality as one of those traumatic encephalopathy syndrome symptoms. So suicidality is just what it says. It's a propensity for someone to either consider or attempt death by suicide. So it's very important. It's important because there's now this public perception that we have created and the press have created in general that if you hit your head, you are now prone to having CTE and hopelessness. And we've gotten that because of the publicized cases, right? The first cases coming from Pittsburgh. And again, the discussion of football players who have become addicted to narcotics and other things, gambling, and eventually taking their lives. So with that, CTE has really kind of taken over. Now, some of the symptoms you look at are these that people present with. And I know this in my practice, because this is a huge concern for people coming into the office who have played not just professional sports, but all level of sports where they have suffered repeated head trauma. So they present, they develop this subjective feeling of cognitive difficulties. I'm becoming more forgetful, can't remember names, losing my keys, losing things. And we've had a detailed discussion on this show with Dr. Cherish Smith about this. Also, symptoms of low testosterone level, persistent headache, and obviously a history of repeated concussions during their lives. These folks are often very depressed or emotional. They have some behavioral problems. They suffer from chronic pain, and they're having these symptoms at a much younger age than you would expect. So again, based on some of these symptoms, people perceive that they have CTE, and they will eventually become incapacitated and have a terrible outcome. And the tragedy of that is that for many of these people, it's got nothing to do with CTE and their symptoms are treatable. So let's look at the study they did. What they did was, of the 4,180 former professional football players in the United States, 1,980 provided follow-up data. So they worked off of a cohort of 1,980 athletes. 34%, a third, a little more than a third of those 1,980 people perceive that they had CTE, that they were going to die and their brains were going to be found to have this condition. 25% of that perceived group, so of those 680, fully 25% had symptoms of suicidality. That means 25% of those people thought about taking their lives, or in fact had attempted to take their lives. So what they did was they compared this, right, to the group that did not perceive that they had CTE. And the suicidality rate among those was only 5%. So clearly, there is this risk factor. So this perception of CTE is now a risk factor for people taking their own lives. So this paper is very important regarding that. And I have this discussion on a regular basis with athletes. My practice is seeing a lot of athletes who have had multiple head injuries, particularly, and not just football players, but boxers, right? When you think about head trauma, you think about boxing. It's the only sport where you can only score points if you neurologically impair your opponent, right? So you have to score a knockout. Now, in football, you're sure you have head trauma, but you still have to score a touchdown to win. So in this case, many people come to my office and they are hockey players, they are boxers, and they are professional bull riders. And that is the cohort that I have worked closely with as a group. And again, they come with this feeling of dread that they have this condition and their lives are changed, especially with respect to behavioral abnormalities. But many of these behaviors are not associated with their head trauma and are related to mental health disorders like depression, like anxiety. So again, these are treatable conditions. So we need to keep this in mind when we hear about what I consider, we've set off somewhat of a paranoia surrounding CTE among athletes. And now it's actually become a risk factor for people taking their own lives by suicide. So something for us to really keep in mind. With that, we're going to take a short break. My guest coming on in the second half hour of our program is going to be Dr. Dina Al-Ramini. Dr. Al-Ramini is a phenomenal surgeon, her phenomenal credentials. She's a cardiac surgeon at Hartford Healthcare, and she has performed the first beating heart transplant in Connecticut. And by the way, I hear that it was done by an all-female team of anesthesia assistants in the room. So again, a remarkable feat, and we want to talk about how a beating heart transplant can really change healthcare in our state and in our country. If you wish to reach me while she is on and you have live questions, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to have my guest today, Dr. Dina Al-Ramini. Dr. Al-Ramini is a cardiac surgeon at Hartford Healthcare, and it always gives me great pleasure when we welcome young physicians to our state. We've had several who have been on in the course of the past few weeks, and Dr. Al-Ramini is no exception to that. She's been here 6 months. And she comes highly credentialed in the field of cardiac surgery and has performed the first beating heart transplant in Connecticut. Dina, welcome to the show.
Hey, Anthony. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's chat. first of all, I looked at your background in education. You know, young people always come to me when they're thinking of going into healthcare, and I say, "Well, have you thought about going to medical school?" And right away, they make that face, and you know the face I'm talking about. All those years of education, but let's talk a little bit about your background, because I don't think there have been many physicians on our program who have spent as much time in specialty training.
Right. It definitely takes so many years to train a heart surgeon. I grew up in Jordan, and I went to school there, and ever since I was young, I knew that I wanted to be a surgeon, and I had the U.S. dream, you know, the American dream, that I wanted to go there and get the best education in the world. So after I finished my medical school there, I was about 26 years old. I came to Chicago and did 5 years of general surgery training. And then after I became a board certified general surgeon, I spent a year in Texas Medical Center, Houston, where I trained in heart and lung transplants. And then I went for additional 2 years to Arizona and did 2 years of cardiothoracic surgery training. And then that was before I joined Hartford. So if you want to count the years, it took 17 years after graduating high school to, complete the journey of becoming a heart surgeon.
So for those young people listening who are thinking of going into healthcare, was it worth it?
I think it's definitely difficult and challenging. I think being on the other side, though, it's very rewarding. The years of training are very rough, but they're also enjoyable. And I would highly encourage people to consider going to medical school. You will graduate. Definitely, you're not going to be making a living at a younger age, but, you will put in the effort. And then once you're fully credentialed and you're helping patients and saving lives, it's very, very rewarding. But you have to be very patient and determined and motivated.
I guess I have to ask you a personal question. Is what motivated you at a young age to know that you wanted to come to the United States to practice?
We have the American dream. As someone who lived outside the United States, we always look up to America. The United States is leading education, research, innovation. They have a very good, well-round structured medical training. It's a fair system. My dad, he was part of the U.S., part of the Jordanian military, so he went on multiple exchange trips with the United States, and he loved it. Hearing about it, following all the science and innovations, it definitely is a privilege to be able to finally come to the United States.
Well, I could say we're happy to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about heart transplantation. Historically, we've talked about it since 1967. We've commemorated several things on this program. But what is it about the heart transplant that fascinates everyone when we hear about it, including myself and other physicians? Historically, why is that?
Well, I mean, for the longest time, there's always been science, there's always been medical science, there's always been surgeries, and but the heart, for the longest time, was thought to be untouchable. You know, people and physicians in the past thought that you cannot touch the heart, you cannot perform surgeries on the heart, and let alone when it's beating. So it took so many years. It's not until, the early 1900s when we really started doing heart surgeries with patients actually surviving. You know, whenever you it's a beating organ, it's a very sacred organ that you can't cut a piece of it out. you're going to have to keep it performing because there's nothing that would keep the body perfused if the heart is not beating. So for the longest time, it was thought that you're not able to operate on the heart. So it took a lot of science and cutting edge innovations, and then the creation of the heart-lung machine, which allows us now to perform heart surgeries, you know, while keeping the person alive.
So, Dina, I mean, performing a heart transplant in general has to take a lot of planning, right? I mean, it's almost like, I mean, everything has to work out perfectly. Can you talk a little bit about what goes into planning just a regular heart transplant for a patient?
Yeah, Anthony, just like you mentioned, it takes a lot of planning. There's so many pieces of the puzzle that has to come together in order to perform one successful heart transplant. You have the donor, you have the recipient. The heart that is being donated has to be a good heart to begin with, and finding a good heart is extremely challenging. You know, we want a perfect heart that can work when we implant it. And then the recipient has to be eligible for the heart transplant. So there's so many factors that can exclude you from getting a heart transplant. You know, for example, multi-system organ failure, in a lot of centers, active smoking or drug abuse can exclude you from getting a heart transplant. So as a recipient, you also have to be eligible. You have to meet certain criteria, and then you have to be evaluated by a whole committee that sees you, make sure that you have the what it takes. Are you going to be able to recover from this big surgery? And then once you're approved by that committee, now finding the perfect match is another whole process. The UNOS would have all these potential organ donors that we take samples from them, and then we take samples from the recipient, and we make sure that their samples are matching so that when we implant the heart, that the body won't reject it. And then suppose all that lines up, then you have to make sure that the size, you know, size matches it is an important thing in heart transplant, making sure that you're not implanting a heart that is too small for the recipient. You can't take a heart from someone who's 5'1" and implant it in someone who's 6'2". Then you haven't helped them. The heart is not a good match. So then finding a good size match is another process. And then once all that aligns, then we send a team to go and see and bring the heart from the donor hospital. So then they go, they make sure that they look at the heart visually, even though we had images and everything confirming that it's good. We want to see visually, is there anything that the images missed? Is the heart actually beating well? And there's not to say, you know, sometimes we go there and even though everything appeared good and we're like, you know, this heart is no good. We can't take it. And sometimes we have to tell the recipients, sorry, you know, after we told them we found the good heart, and then they're waiting, we're like, we went there and checked, and it was not a good heart for implantation. So there's so many obstacles in the way, but you know, a lot when it's meant to be, it's meant to be. When everything is aligned, we want perfect organ to go for the suitable recipient. So a lot of planning and a lot of science that goes behind the scenes.
And I guess the timing is key, right? So you have to often go to another state to get the heart, right? Fly it back and then coordinate with a team to look at all of these different things. How much does that take in terms of planning?
That's a great question. You know, matching the recipient operating room time with the donor time is key. For the longest time and historically, it was thought that the heart can only survive 4 hours on ice. So if you take a heart, by the time it's outside of somebody's chest and on an ice box, you have 4 hours to fly it over and implant it in the recipient. And that's how we did it in my training in Texas and Arizona. It's a speed game where there's a team that goes gets the heart, and most likely, really not more than 90% of the organs they're flown from another state. they're not really local. So you have the addition of transport time to the airport, and then the flight to that state, and then driving back from the airport of the recipient. So it's a lot of coordination planning. It can be really, really tight. Now, there are new innovations. Now we have the Paragonics, we have the Transmedics system, which are able to preserve the heart and for longer than 4 hours. So we have more leeway that we can plan. It's just that it's not as tight as having the heart preserved only on ice.
I have a question. Joe just called, just sent me an email, and I want to know how many heart transplants do we perform at Hartford Hospital and maybe in the whole state or country, if you would know that. I mean, what numbers are we talking about in terms of performing heart transplants?
An average of 30 to, you know, there were years where we did 40, up to 40. It's a range. It depends on the pool of organs and recipients, but I would say an average of 30 at Hartford. The other center that performs heart transplants are Yale, they do about the same number. So we are the two centers that carry the majority of the weight of heart transplantation in the state of Connecticut.
I read somewhere where there are about 3,400 people waiting for heart transplants in the United States. Is that pretty accurate?
That is correct. That's actually from a SRTR website, that there's 3,500 patients right now waiting for hearts. And unfortunately, the hearts available don't meet the need of the patients that are in need. And that's why there's a nationwide initiative to increase and encourage people to become organ donors, because we have severe shortages in good hearts.
So you've taken a huge step in solving that problem. Let's talk about the procedure you performed, the beating heart transplant, and maybe how that's going to help get more hearts to people.
Right. So we did the first beating heart transplant in Connecticut, in Hartford. We're very proud of it. This is us. It's not a very new science, but it's taking a new nationwide adaptation. Still, I think there's only 100 beating heart transplants that have been performed, or a little bit over that, till this day. They probably, it's less than 0.001% of the total transplants that are done. The beating heart transplant is basically we typically implant the heart when it's still and it's not moving. We call it a non-beating heart. So you sew it in, because the heart has five connections. So you connect these five connections, and then you perfuse the heart, and then the heart starts pumping, and that would be the non-beating part of it. But then there's a new initiative to kind of start to not stop the heart, just do it while it's beating, because when you stop the heart suffers slow damage. So the faster you are, the better the heart is preserved. So beating heart transplant is kind of a way in avoiding that additional damage to the heart that it suffers when you stop it. It has. We still definitely need more studies in randomized controlled trials to show us a clear benefit. I wouldn't say I would use it for every single patient. I usually tailor it to my patients, to those who I think would benefit from it. But yeah, we're hoping that this technique would kind of limit the additional damage that would happen to the heart when you stop it.
So, you know, when I think of transplanting organs, I'm a neurologist, right? So naturally, it's when I see someone who no longer has brain function, their heart's still beating, we could keep it beating. So from that point, right, what happens? You take the person to the operating room, you remove the heart that was beating, and obviously now it stops beating, correct?
Correct. And you have to preserve it. So there's a special solution that you infuse the heart with before you take it out of somebody's chest to make sure that it's preserved. It's usually called Del Nido solution. So once the heart is preserved, then you put it on ice. You wrap it in a cooler and take it or fly it to the recipient's room, operating room. And there is a new technology called Transmedics where you take the heart and you don't have to stop it. You actually just keep it perfused, that you connect it to all these lines, and then the heart would be beating the entire flight inside the box.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where I didn't kind of connect this. Now, there is some talk where, you know, typically you would not take the heart from someone who suffers a cardiac death, right? So they didn't suffer a brain death. They had, you know, their heart stopped for some reason. Are those hearts now more eligible for transplantation?
Are you referring to the donation after cardiac death?
Yeah,
that's there's donation after brain death, which is really straightforward. There's objective evidence that the donor has no brain function. So then, you know, they become organ donors. But then the donation after cardiac death was kind of formed for those patients who are not completely brain dead. They would still have brain stem reflexes, so they can't declare them brain dead. But then at the same time, there's no meaningful recovery in sight. And then they wanted to become organ donors. So then what do you do? How you can't just take their organs out while they're still, you know, having their eyes open, they have pupillary reflexes, or they are overbreathing the vent. So then the whole science of donation after cardiac death came out. Basically, what happens is that you would terminally extubate these patients, and then they have about 2 hours. If they expire within 2 hours, then you pronounce them dead, and then you honor, moment of silence and let the family kind of have their last moments. And then after that, you take them to the operating room and then take their organs out and try to quickly resuscitate their organs and take them while they're still viable. Now, there is, by definition, these organs have already suffered damage.
That's what I wanted to get to. Exactly.
Correct. So we see more higher rates of primary graft dysfunction with donation after cardiac death, and that's why the beating heart technique kind of was incorporated after DCD donations, because then you don't have to arrest the heart another time, because that heart is already kind of suffered some damage, which, you know, conceivably will recover from, but you don't want to add another period of ischemia, so then you just sew it while it's beating.
Has this technology now helped us with respect to having more eligible cardiac donors?
Yes, it definitely did, and that's why it was adopted, because it definitely extended the donor criteria pool 100%. Now when I get the heart offers, almost half of them are DCD donors. So imagine, we didn't even see any of these donors in the past. So definitely they're adding. It's a science that's still evolving, so there's a lot to be learned. We don't know. Sometimes we send a team and then the donor would not expire. We would extubate the patient and then they would not progress. So sometimes we're having some dry runs. We call them dry runs, that we go and we come back with no organ because the donor never passed. So it is a science that is still evolving to see what are the predictors that would help us identify the successful DCD donors. But there's a lot of science in this, and it's still evolving.
I got to ask you a question. What's it like? I mean, what's it like when you take a heart and just sew it back into somebody and essentially bring them back alive? I guess I got to ask you that. What's that feeling like?
I mean, it fascinates me every time. there is a period of time where the recipient, when we take out their native heart, there's a period of time where they don't have anything in their chest. And that's fascinating, but they're still alive. They're still on the heart-lung machine. And then when you bring this new, fresh, healthy heart and you start sewing it in, a lot of the times the heart starts beating on its own. I mean, sometimes we have to give it a little shock to wake it up. But, you know, a lot of the times it just starts beating and it kind of incorporates into the body and the patients kind of, you know, wake up feeling new, jump start, new life, you know. It still fascinates me every time.
Nina, in closing, I guess I wanted to ask you, what's something in terms of the future of your field that our listeners may not be aware of?
I think we're in a great field. There's a lot of medicine, science, and innovation in it. I think there is a lot of shortage in heart transplants, you know, meeting the needs between the number of donors and the vast number of the recipients. So there's a lot of innovation in mechanical circulatory support, which are these little pumps, the devices that are basically total artificial hearts or a left heart pump or right heart pump. There's a lot of innovation going we call it MCS or mechanical circulatory support, to kind of bridge the gap between and help these patients that are still suffering from heart failure, but then there's not an available organ for them. That I think these heart pumps are the future because they're evolving in a very rapid fashion, and they're very advanced, and they help a lot of those patients on the wait list.
Nina, thank you very much. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for everything you do for our community. And I could tell you, when young people come to me and they're not sure that they want to go to medical school and put in all that training, I'm going to give them your phone number, okay, as proof that it's worthwhile. And for our listeners, if you wish to reach Dr. El-Ramini, 860-696-5520. Nina, thank you for your time today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. You guys have a good day.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Many thanks to our studio producer today. It's been Kevin Kors has been on the board, and as always, Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. I hope all our listeners learned something today, because I know I sure did, from Dr. Dina El-Ramini. Next up on WTIC is going to be Patriots football. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rachford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.